God, I'm so happy wine is present.
We're going to need it.
Yeah. I need it to tell the story, so you're going to definitely need it to hear it.
Great. Okay, well, welcome to DNA True Crime
Podcast. Alrighty then, we're right in there.
I'm Devin, the D.
And I'm Asia, the A.
And this week, Asia is telling us a story.
Yeah, I'm telling you a story that I think you might have heard it already, but I'm not sure.
We'll find out. Before we get into it, we're going to say a disclaimer. This is not for children. This is very much an adult podcast because of the stuff we talk about. Just a warning.
Yeah.
And go ahead and subscribe if you haven't already. Give us a review, all that good stuff. We're
download
happy to have you
the
here.
The first two episodes.
Yeah, go catch up. Yep. And then you'll have a little more insight into this one.
Yeah.
And we ready to go?
We're ready to go. All the right. One thing I do want to say first is that there's a little warning on top of that for this story, that it's not meant for all ears. And I don't mean that just for like young children. I mean that some people may be a little sensitive to the content I'm talking about.
Oh, God. Okay.
Because this story does contain crimes against children. So please use discretion. And I know that Devin and I did at one point loosely agree not to do children. But to be so honest, this was just a story that I could not let go of. Like every single time I went to like put this away and be like, we're not doing this, I would research something else. And this same, like the same article would pop up, or like a name would pop up about like, you know, a missing black woman or a missing minority or whatever the location I was looking up. So it was following me. I felt like it was following me. This is the story of the Freeway Phantom Murders. The Freeway Phantom, a name that was given to the killer by the media, was active in Washington, D.C. from April 1971 through September 1972. However, I don't believe for a second that this was his only time killing, or like the beginning and the end of his killings. During this time, it was a year and 5 months, the Freeway Phantom would claim the lives of six young women, ranging from ages 10 to 18. Yeah. All right. Whew. The story takes place in the 70s. So keep in mind, this was a time when like kids were given a lot of freedom to do whatever they want. They were very independent. This was a time when you like didn't lock your doors.
Yeah.
Like I didn't grow up in that. Like, no. I remember my parents locking the door, but I do remember it being way more loose. Like, if you forgot to lock the door, who cares, you know? But, like, this was a time where, like, it didn't matter, you
know?
It was
be suspicious if you did lock your doors.
Yes, like, if you locked your doors, you were keeping something in, you know? And this is also just shy of the three-year anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., so racial inequality is a huge deal, and as we know it, continuing to this day. So, all right. So let's go with May 1st, 1971 at 2:46 p.m. The body of an African-American girl was found behind the St. Elizabeth Hospital. It's right next to the northbound lanes of I-295 in Washington, D.C. Her autopsy confirmed that she had been sexually assaulted, beaten, and ultimately strangled to death. She also had citrus fruit in her stomach, which was odd because her family was like, she didn't have citrus that day. Like, we didn't, that's not what we had for dinner. So
like an orange? or something?
It just said citrus fruit. So, and I don't think when they do like stomach contents that they can actually tell. It's like, unless it's whole, like whole pieces of something, that they like there was citric acid in her stomach.
Got it.
Which just proves that the killer actually held her and fed her through this time.
Oh, jeez.
There were also green synthetic fibers found on her body. She was fully clothed, but missing her shoes. It was revealed that she had only been killed a couple days before her body was found. And this precious little angel was eventually identified as Carol Denise Spinks. She was known as Bebe to her siblings. She was a shy 13-year-old girl from Southeast. I'm so bad at geography, so I'm like, where Southeast of what?
Never
like, where is
soggy
it?
Soggy waffles. Okay, Southeast.
Yeah, so Southeast.
Okay.
So and that's how the location of all of these young girls are described. They're like Southeast or Southwest or whatever, however, okay. Wherever they were in that.
Mm-hmm.
So she was from Southeast. She was an identical twin.
Oh my God.
I know. But she did, her passions were jumping double Dutch rope.
Oh,
isn't that the cutest?
Baby.
Playing jacks and showing off her hula hoop skills.
Oh my gosh.
Precious baby.
I love her.
Carol was sent to the local 7-Eleven by her older sister, Valerie, who was 24 at the time. She convinced her to go take the trip, even though their mother, Allentine, that's their mother's name, told the younger children not to leave the apartment while she was out visiting their aunt. And Valerie had an apartment across the hallway from them because she was 24, so she had her own apartment. And then the kids were in the other apartment. So Valerie convinces her to go take this trip because she's like, if you go, I'll give you $5, pick up, you know, bread and milk, and you can get a soda if you go. So yeah, like as a kid, you're like, yeah, like I don't, of course.
Yeah, and
you know?
you're like 13.
Yeah.
You're like, of course you can like manage a trip to 7-Eleven. That's no big deal.
Exactly. And even though like the consequences, their mother was very strict. So she knew like by disobeying her mom that like, and her, it was, she's one of 8 children. So like her mom was probably like, yeah, don't mess around. My mom had like, my mom had 4 kids and she was like, so I could imagine like having 8 kids and really needing to be, but like she, like her method of choice was like, you pick the belt or the whip or the extension cord and that was your punishment. But she's taken this trip to 7-Eleven so many times. It's only 4 blocks away from their house. But along the way she runs into her mom and her mom is pissed. So she's like, go to the store and then get your ass back, and then you're gonna pick your punishment.
Oh,
so she's like,
she has
I'm
to
sure
do the chore
and then also she's like walking into you know.
Oh,
so
God.
I could imagine what's like running through her head at that point. Like, let me take my time,
you
know, because I don't want to get back home and get in trouble.
Yeah.
But along, you know, on her way home, unfortunately, she never makes it there because she meets the last person that will see her alive, the freeway phantom. Horrible. Her mother files a missing persons report that same night because obviously she just saw her daughter. She was supposed to come right back. Like, there's, like, it doesn't take an hour to walk 4 blocks.
Right.
The 7-Eleven clerk did tell police that she saw Carol leave with the bag of stuff. So she knows that she did. They know that she did make it to the 7-Eleven. She just didn't make it home from there. Carol's identical twin sister says that she remembers the detectives knocking on the door, and she still dreams of that blood curdling scream her mom makes when they tell her about Carol's fate. I know this is hard to hear. I'm so sorry. I'm doing this to you guys too. So I sincerely apologize. Carol's, this is her twin sister, and she, this is, you know, obviously years later, and she's saying that, you know, eventually she did turn to drugs and prostitution because of what happened to her sister. And she says that she just remembers like sitting on the couch all the time and just feeling like she was losing her mind because like she had just this piece of her that would never come back, you know? So she also did an interview with WUSA 9 and she says, I still talk to her every day. Basically, I just tell her I hope she's okay and I'm sure she is.
Oh my God.
Valerie Moore, who was the older sister that sent her to the store, says that she still carries that guilt that she just, you never think.
I can't imagine that.
You don't think that, like, something so innocent, something like a trip she takes all the time, something that she probably took with her more than once, that she would never see her again. She said that months after, even years, she would take that same route because she was, like, at night and she was afraid. But she said, quote, I was afraid, but I just wanted to know who would do this. So she was hoping that by walking the same route that he would come back and pick her up so that she would know who did it. Her sister's now, she's 71 now. Wow. So she's giving these interviews like, 50 years later. Evander, Carol's other sister, said that at that point she did kind of the opposite thing. She just got really tough, you know, and she's like, it made her very protective of her other sisters and brothers. And she said, I got mean, mad, and bad. If anybody even looked at any of us funny, I was fighting. And I was like, yep, cool. Yep, that's exactly how I feel like I would react.
That's such an interesting, like, look at the way, like, the impact grief has on individuals, and like, even though they're all from the same home, what a different world it creates for each and every one of them.
Yeah,
something they never should have had to deal with.
I know, it's terrible. Nearly 5 decades later, Evander Spinks still hopes to tell her sister one more thing: that we know who did this. So about 2.5 months later, July 8th, 1971, Darlena Denise Johnson, a 16-year-old African-American girl from Congress Heights, was on her way to her summer job. The Oxon, I hope that's how you say it, Oxon Hill Recreation Center. Darlena apparently told her mom she was planning to stay the night over there, like she was going to work all day, and then they were having a sleepover for the kids at the rec center, so she was going to stay overnight. But she never showed up to work. So her mom wouldn't have noticed, but it was because she didn't show up that they called and they were like, where is she? She didn't show up. So 11 days later, her body was found just 15 feet away from where Carol's body was found.
Oh, along my freeway.
Yeah. This is where I like got, like, I put this case down and then I picked it back up at like reading about Darlena, and then I got angry and then kept reading and then and also this case is still unsolved, so that's what made me even more want to do it, because it was like, I need, like, I don't know how much of an impact I can make about bringing attention to this case, but if it's just a little bit, like, by retelling this story, it's good enough for me, you know? So this is where I got real pissed. So her body was found 11 days later, but police were notified by an anonymous caller about the location of Darlena's body a week before they went out to find it. And the person that made this anonymous call knew certain details about the body and the location of the body that really only the killer would know. And there's,
why would they,
conflicting reports. Call? Like, some people say that it, like, it could have been the Phantom that was just trying to basically insert himself into the investigation in a way.
Yeah.
Or it could have just been an anonymous caller that saw the body and just said a bunch of details to whoever. But either way, waiting a week.
Why did it take a week?
Okay, I'll let you know. So, And then it another report says that two people, even before this happened, called the police about the body, but nothing happened. Yeah. According to a book called Tantamount, The Pursuit of the Freeway Phantom by Blaine Pardoe and Victoria Hester, apparently two officers in a patrol car did respond. They drove by, didn't see anything, and then they called dispatch back and said, 10-8, we didn't find anything.
Fuck them.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. What?
Yes. So according to Romaine Jenkins, she's was one of the detectives on the case and somebody who's still involved. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of information from the Washington Post, which is basically an article about her because she was on it from the beginning. So I'll reference her a lot and I'll reference her by Jenkins because that's her last name. Mm-hmm. So she said that apparently the officers didn't get out to look. They just drove by, didn't see anything, and then just said, we didn't find anything. So I don't know where that, like, why somebody would call because we didn't find anything.
I want to be a cop because you don't have to do anything.
You just
drive around and get a fucking donut.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't see. Are you?
I'm not kidding, actually.
Oh, it's my God.
Infuriating. So now you see why I was like, I can't, I have to, I have to do this because
it's not like it's like a shoe.
No, no. Oh. So then now a week later on July 19th.
That is so long. That is so long.
It's too long. It's too long.
That's insane.
So July 19th, one of the callers, one of the original callers returns to the location and is like, what the fuck?
Good for them.
They're like, I called like a week ago about this. Like, imagine being like,
imagine A, finding a body.
Yeah.
B, going back because you don't trust the authorities and being proven right.
Yes.
Holy shit.
So he, because now, I mean, this is a little sensitive, but because of the heat, the body was rotting. So like they were like, so just angry by the inaction of the police, this man calls again and he saw it and then phoned his friend who was a DC police sergeant. His name was Charles Badden. He was off duty that day, but he said, quote, he told me exactly where it was on the freeway opposite the 295, just north of Bowling Air Force Base. He said, I asked him if he called the police, and he said, yeah, a week ago, but nobody came. So Officer Badden, off-duty cop, gets on his motorcycle and drives the route, drives the shoulder, and until he finds the body. Because it was a week, and plus she was also, she was
already like a week.
It had already been a week since she, So this made it almost nearly impossible to identify the cause of death. Even though now that we know she was one of the Freeway Phantom victims, that most likely what was done to her was done to the last two victims.
But still, or if you've been able to connect.
She's the second.
Yeah. If you were able to connect those two and maybe there was some clue that wasn't destroyed after laying out.
For over a week,
Have you ever left like a chair in the sun for a week?
Yeah. Like I sat in the sun for like literally 20 minutes the other day and my skin was red.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Oh my God.
So obviously the body had decomposed faster than it normally would have. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't tell if she was sexually assaulted as Carol was. But one thing they could confirm was that there were signs of strangulation. Mm-hmm. Darlenia was also found fully clothed but missing her shoes.
Weird.
Her face was so badly decomposed that the medical examiner. Okay, before I say this,
I just got chills.
Yes. Do you want me to say this is tough?
Yeah.
Okay. If any listeners don't want to hear, this is not great. So just like skip forward like 15 seconds. her face and body were so badly decomposed that the medical examiner had to cut off her fingers to identify her. Back then, there was no DNA testing because it was the 70s. So the authorities only had fingerprints to go on or facial recognition. So that was the only way that they could figure out who she was. How she died couldn't be determined. Maybe, according to Jenkins, if they had located the body sooner, we could have had an official cause of death. There was a witness to Darlenia's disappearance. Someone reported to have seen Darlenia in an old black car driven by an African-American male around the time of her disappearance. According to the Washington Post article that I found with Romaine Jenkins, she said that it was eventually found out that her boyfriend, she was with her boyfriend right before she vanished. So there's some discrepancy. Yeah. Like, I think what might have happened is that she told her mom she was going to work, but she was meeting him first, maybe, and then was going to go to work. Yeah. But that was something that was not released to the public at the time because the her boyfriend's mom would not let him testify or not let him speak to the police at all. So she kind of kept him.
It's not a bad.
Yeah. I mean, I could understand like having my child like involved in something or having seen someone right before they die. And being like,
and obviously the police work isn't going to be great on this if they let her body stay out. So they're just going to try to pin it on whoever comes in front of them first. Yeah.
So it was, I mean, you know, that, at that point, everybody was kind of aware what was happening, now being the second case on the freeway. Parents were warning their children at the time on the southeast. So the killer, his next victim, was in the northwest. And just 19 days after Darlenia's murder, the freeway phantom strikes again. On July 27th, 1971, around 7 p.m., our youngest victim, 10-year-old Brenda Faye Crockett, was sent to the store by her mom. When she didn't return, her mom and her boyfriend searched the neighborhood for Brenda. I'm a little confused about why, like, what happens next, but more on the side of the Phantom, which I hate giving him, like, a cool name like that, because you're not cool. You're actually a piece of shit, so.
It should be, like, the coward.
Yeah, like, something molester. Not cool. Yeah, like, actually call him what he is. Yeah. He's a fucking murderer.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah.
So Brenda, so her mom is out kind of looking around the area. Some conflicting reports said that her boyfriend was with her looking for Brenda, and that Brenda's little sister was home alone. And when I first read that, I was like, what? Because I was like, first of all, like, what is running through your head as a mom when, like, that, like, your child is missing? Like, there's no way I'm leaving my 7-year-old at home. Like,
I don't know if I'm panicking, I'm running out in the street. I'm not even like,
but like my first thought was like another kid sitting home alone. Well, like how
the fact that they said like home alone, I'm like, oh no, what's going to happen to her?
No, no. So nothing happens to her. Good. But then I did find another report that said that the boyfriend was home with the 7-year-old. So the mom was out searching and the boyfriend was home with Brenda's little sister. So Brenda's little sister is home, waiting to see if Brenda shows up. But around 9:20 p.m., the phone rings. And it's Brenda crying on the other line.
Oh, my God.
And she says, a white man picked me up, and I'm headed home now in a cab. Okay. What? First question. Why does he let her call home?
Or is it like is he telling her to say something to get attention off him?
So that's, I don't know. So I still, I'm kind of like, I don't think anybody really knows what the deal is here because so far he hadn't done that for any of the other victims.
But if he was the one that did the anonymous call for Carol, he is into some weird things.
Yeah.
He wants attention. He wants attention.
For sure.
Caught maybe.
Yeah. So, and it's kind of risky, too, and it doesn't really make sense because it's like, at this point, you're literally making contact with with the family.
Yes.
And, I mean, another, like, it's the 70s, so, like, how is she saying she's headed home in a cab if, and she's talking on the phone?
I just think that means like he's probably being like, I'm going to send you home in a cab.
And okay, like, he's telling her,
like feeding her, mm-hmm. or, you know. I don't think she's physically in the cab on the phone.
Yeah, like
I think it's like a.
But the way, I mean, maybe
present participle or whatever. Yeah,
maybe just because it's just like she's head. I'm headed home in a cab means like now in my.
In my head, I imagined that he was like the cab's on its way. You're going to be heading home. Let them know that you're on your way.
Okay. So.
Ugh, fuck
yeah. She also tells her sister that she thinks she's in Virginia, before she can, like, her sister can say anything else or anything like that, she just suddenly whispers bye and hangs up.
Oh my God. Ooh, was it a secret phone call?
That's what I'm saying. Like, because she's whispering.
I still think that she's being told this information by this person.
And it's like, but maybe why would he offer up? Called. Why would he offer up that he's a white male?
She can see him.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, if he's the one that's dictating this to her, why would he tell her to say it's a white man? Which makes me think that it's not. Because that way he can throw them off. Because the only reason why I feel like he would do this is because he feels like maybe he could be caught. So he's trying to throw them off.
Yeah.
But this is why I really think that. Because she whispers bye and hangs up. But the calls don't end there. She calls back again. And this time, the boyfriend answers. And she tells him basically the same thing, that a white man took me. I'm headed home in a cab. And she says, and he asks her, where are you? Like, can I come pick you up? And she says, no. Did my mother see me?
What?
And then he says, wait a minute, how could your mom see you if you're in Virginia? And then she just tells him, I'm alone in the house with a white man. And he says, then like silence, and he hears heavy footsteps in the background. And then Brenda whispers, I'll see you. And then the line goes dead.
Oh my God.
So...
What?
Yeah. So the police believe that it's the killer forcing her to make this call.
Mm-hmm. Was he a cab driver? So ooh, she maybe. Was headed home in a cab?
Maybe. And he picked her up in a cab, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. But so they think that he's forcing her to make the calls to throw the police off the track.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that, like, what track? Like, there, like, he knows obviously then there he's killed two people or three people at this point. Why, like, there isn't, it's like, just no, a there's weird no track
game,
you know, there's no track. The police aren't like knocking at his door. The only thing that I think is maybe, like, he picks her up, and when her mom realizes that she's not home and runs out to try to look around the neighborhood, they see her mom. Because he's got her in the car. Yeah. So then she's like, that's why she's asking, did my mom see me?
Oh my God.
And he knows, the killer knows that, oh, that's her mom.
Yeah.
So he's asking her to ask him that so that he can tell if he was seen with her.
Oh.
Which is like, but then that also makes me believe that it's somebody that they know.
Right.
Because how would he know what her mom
looks
like?
That's what I was thinking. Unless she's like, that's my mom.
Well, I mean, she could, but then she's very calm through this whole thing. So I feel like this has to be a guy that she...
Which, you know, to be fair, or like, mm-hmm. you know, about the calmness, when people are in a situation like that, especially young kids, mm-hmm. they're not necessarily... Like, they're trustful of adults. They're doing what the adult is saying to, you know, survive or whatever. They're not, I don't know if, like, the immediate fight instinct is like developed in them.
Yeah. Because they're taught to be submissive to,
right,
to authority.
And like respect adult. Her calmness to me indicates maybe it's not a white man, because if she grew up in a predominantly black area and was alone in a house with a white man, like I could see why it would be normal for her to be like, this white dude picked me up. Like, that's weird.
Yeah.
But if she's very calm about it.
Mm-hmm. And he's just saying to her, seem like, this is what you should say when you call your mom.
Right.
Or when you call home.
Oh my
it's so God, weird.
That's so fucking creepy.
I mean, if this isn't that and he's not trying to throw the police off, then this is just a way to torment the family, which we know serial killers love to do.
True.
So the next day, which is actually only a couple hours later, because at 5:50 a.m., hitchhikers find Brenda's body along Route 50. She is fully clothed with a scarf knotted around her neck. But again, she's missing her shoes. Like Carol, she was raped, beaten, and strangled.
Oh, my God.
Also, like Carol, she had the green synthetic fibers on her clothes as well.
Like a shag rug or something?
I don't know. And you know what? And these little, like, minute details that connect all of them...
Mm-hmm.
Just, I mean, I know I have to remember that this is the 70s and they don't have the, like, the technology that we have
but
now.
But it seems like it's right there.
Like, yeah, like, they're, yeah. they always get to, like, just almost figuring it out or just having the right clue to connect everything, and then it falls apart.
Yeah.
So, Prince George County homicide detective Hillary, I am not going to try to pronounce your last name, sweetheart. I'm so sorry, but I think. Sidskowski? I'm so sorry. I probably botched that, but I'm so sorry. Okay, but Hillary, she was only 27 at the time, said she was there on the scene and said that they had to put clear plastic bags over her tiny little hands so that they could preserve the evidence before placing her into the body bag because of the way that her body was... found. They didn't want to lose any evidence under her nails. She and also Carol had defensive wounds, so they definitely tried to take a piece out of him. Jenkins, she also had a theory about the call, and she thought that, you know, that the killer knew Brenda and her mom and wanted to find out if she saw, you know, or she saw them together. Because why, she said, quote, why would you let her call home? Not once, but twice.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. She said, quote, he had to make sure that her mother didn't see her.
Yeah.
And I know that for a fact. So
I think
he's just
maybe
a local guy that, like, they, you know, I don't know. So Brenda's sister, I'm just doing like a little snippet of like, you know, siblings and who are surviving siblings that gave quotes now. So almost 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So Brenda's sister said she started with drugs that year. She didn't go to college and became a single mom a month before her 18th birthday. She said, quote, if Brenda was living, I would have done everything different. I wish I could have grown up with her. We could have encouraged each other to be better women. Okay, so 10 p.m. on October 1st, 1971, a 16-year-old boy found the still warm body of another young girl who was found on the shoulder of Pennsylvania Avenue in Prince George's County, Maryland. She was later identified as 12-year-old Ninaushima Yates. I'm going to call her Yates from now on because I have a feeling that I'm not saying her name right. I hate doing last names because I feel like it kind of makes it really it's not as personal, and I want them to be called by their first name, so I'm just gonna say Yates so I don't make a mistake. So Yates was walking home from Safeway grocery store around 7 p.m. to buy sugar, flour, and paper plates. Her stepmother had just had a baby, and Yates's dad needed to be with his wife and the newborn at the hospital, so she was going to get stuff for the house. this is after the discovery of Yates's body is when they started to call him the Freeway Phantom, because obviously mm-hmm. all the bodies were found along a freeway. Mm-hmm. The autopsy revealed, like the other victims, that she was raped and strangled. Mm-hmm. She was also fully clothed, with her shoes missing.
What is that about?
I don't know. I don't. They still don't know. They still have no idea.
Trophies and, must be right.
I don't know, because you'll later on. Okay.
I'll let you tell the story. Yeah. I guess.
Thanks. There were also green fibers found on her body as well. And a witness claims to have seen Yates get into a blue Volkswagen, which earlier they said Darlenia was in a black car with an African-American man. So it's very conflicting reports. I don't know. I can't figure out like where I can't find. And you also can't find any documents like containing any like. Statements, because like obviously I'm not a police officer, so I can't access that stuff.
Everything is like handwritten and shit.
Yeah. So, but like I don't know, like it doesn't show whether any of these, like reports were ever followed up on, or if those leads were ever carried out. They did search for the car, but that ended up leading nowhere. Mm. And throughout reading about all of these cases, I was thinking like. What did he say to them?
Yeah.
You know,
well, the citrus fruit with Carol, I was like, did he like
have a
nice juicy orange? And he was like, hey, do you want some?
I don't know, because
come look in my trunk. I got more.
You know what? The thing that bothers me a little bit is because they're all young. So I get that. Yes. But some are a little bit older, so you would think that there would be a little less, credulous.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, for a 10-year-old, yes, you could say, like, hey, I have candy, or I have a present, or your mom sent me to pick you up, or whatever, but a 16-year-old?
If he knew Brenda, it wouldn't be that hard
to
get her.
Yeah.
But this is also the time where people would just, like, give each other rides down to the store. It was no big deal. Like, you said, people didn't lock their doors.
Yeah.
People would get ride. Like, hitchhiking was an actual thing that more people hitchhiked than were murdered hitchhiking. You know?
Yeah.
Like, enough people were murdered that now we don't hitchhike anymore.
Yeah.
But, like, people did that because not everybody had cars.
I mean, and there wasn't many witnesses to the cases or to, like, the abductions themselves. And but when there are, they don't say anything about a struggle. So they got in willingly. So it's like, what is he offering? Is he offering them something they can't refuse? And that's why they get in without a problem?
But it's also like, these are the stories why now women and we teach our kids to not do this.
Mm-hmm.
This is still a new thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, true.
So.
And this is, they do coin this as the first serial killer of Washington, D.C. They had not seen something like this before.
Yeah.
So I could also understand why some of the police didn't treat this as seriously as they should have in the beginning, because it was like, oh, this is just a one-off thing. Like, you know, but after the third, I'm pretty sure we have a problem, dude.
Yeah.
So a month and a half later, it's now November 15th, 1971. Brenda Denise Woodward, an 18-year-old from Baltimore.
Another Brenda.
We'll get into that. She's from Baltimore. She boards a bus to head home from dinner with a friend to Maryland Avenue, where she lived. It's about 8:30 p.m. So the next day, 6 hours later, her body is discovered by Chevrolet police officer David Norman. He was 22.
Mm. All these young people finding all the bodies.
And the young police officers, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Was Brenda at dinner with a friend, or was she on the bus with a friend?
She boarded a bus after having dinner with a friend.
Okay, got it.
Yeah,
okay.
So she had dinner with a friend and then got on the bus and headed to Maryland Avenue.
Okay.
So 6 hours later, her body was discovered by David Norman just off the ramp of Route 202. He said, I shined my flashlight in her eyes to see if there was life. there was nothing. This her situation was a little bit different than the other women. Brenda was also stabbed multiple times and strangled.
He's evolving.
She had defensive wounds on her hands as well, so it confirmed that she fought her attacker.
I wish everybody could see my face right now.
Yeah.
I hate this guy so much.
Me too.
Yeah. I don't even know what to say.
You know, Go I think on. This is one of those cases where you just don't have anything to say. It's are just evil. Yeah. Like, there's no other way to describe.
Yeah. It's almost who like can do this to the children. Unsolved ones. Mm-hmm. We don't get a chance to like kind of like explain away the history of abuse and all this stuff because like that, like the why of the killer sometimes make it easier to swallow. Cope with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when it's unsolved, it's just like pure. All we have to go on is the act itself, which is just pure evil and so unfathomable.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. I don't really have any words other than what people put in these articles to say about it, because it's just heart-wrenching. So she was also found fully clothed, but she was wearing her shoes. So just a little differences that I don't understand. She also had a coat placed over her chest with a note in the pocket.
What? Mm-hmm. So ooh, I hate him.
You're going to hate him even more in a second. Whoa. So the note read, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit to the others when you catch me, if you can." Signed, Freeway Phantom.
Fuck this guy. So,
I know. Get mad. I want you to.
So the fucking media. Brand.
You're about to come out of your seat. I
cannot believe this. They brand him the Freeway Phantom, and then he's like, hello, I'm going to come out, and I'm going to claim this. What fucking nerve. And then to use her.
Yeah.
Like, as a calling card.
Yeah.
Like, oh, hi, this is my business card. It's a human body.
He uses her like she's a fucking dove that he's like strapping something to her to send a message. And it's ridiculous. And I do want to kind of break it down.
Wow.
Because I did copy and paste what Wikipedia had as what the letter said.
Okay.
Which is weird because Wikipedia had the note like rewritten, and certain letters were capitalized and certain letters were...
Was it mimicking his handwriting?
No, because I found the actual note.
Oh, God.
And it's not like that. But for some reason on Wikipedia, it's done like that. Okay. But, you know, anybody can update Wikipedia. So if you want to see the picture of the note, I'll post it on our Instagram at @DNA_podcast. Also, the word insensitivity is spelled wrong. So,
because he's an idiot.
Yeah, he's not. I don't think he's smart, but I think I say that about everybody that we talk about.
The word choice in that is interesting in the note, because tantamount, it sounds tantamount to my insensitivity. It sounds like somebody who like doesn't quite know what the words mean, but is trying to be very eloquent.
Like, and sound smarter than he is, for sure.
Yes.
Like, almost like if in the 70s we had like a thesaurus he used a stupid word.
Thesaurus
no, but existed. Like where he could have like just clicked on the thing and said this word I want to find a different word that sounds smarter, because I do that a lot in my writing. So I'm like, that word means the same thing.
I was like, you know, they had thesaurus.
No, I do know that. I'm just saying, like, as easy as it would have been, like, writing this note, that he could just click on that word and be like, oh, here's a smarter word I
this
could use.
This equals my hate. Yeah. This is tantamount to my insensitivity.
Yeah. He's an idiot.
Fuck this guy.
So insensitivity is spelled wrong. And he's also taunting the police, and he's pretty much like admitting that there's more women out there that he's attacked.
And he's going to keep doing it.
And he's going to keep doing it if they can catch him.
But you know what fucking grinds my gears
is that uses the name.
No. Well, oh. Yes. Listen, every bit of this grinds my gears.
Okay.
But that they didn't catch him.
I know.
And this fucking idiot is smarter than all the police in the whole world in 1971.
Somehow he
fucking
eluded them by because not you know being what? Smart.
You have to follow the rules if you're a cop. Well, I don't know.
I mean, that's, that could be there's a gray area we there.
You could spend a year talking about that.
Yeah, but. True.
Whatever. Like, anyways,
10 seasons of our podcast will be able to cover that.
Yeah. Stay tuned.
Yeah. So, and like you said, the most annoying part of it is that he signs it the Freeway Phantom.
Mm-hmm.
But what's really annoying to me is that he signs it Free-Way Phantom.
Don't go throwing hyphens where they're not needed.
Yeah. Like, what? Like, why?
This is what I mean, though. This guy has no idea what the fuck he's doing.
No.
It's a guy who thinks he wants to be smarter, mm-hmm. but he's a real idiot.
Yeah. Like, freeway is one word, dude.
One way. One way. One no, way. Freeway is two ways. It's one word.
Yeah, it's one word. Ways. It's two ways.
I've been dealing with hyphens my whole life.
I know. You know. It's in your name.
Don't mess with them.
So the police do test the note and they match it to other things written by Brenda, and Brenda's the one that wrote the note.
It's like the call.
Mm-hmm.
It's the call, but with the note.
Yes.
Oh, so wait, was I just making fun of the way she wrote?
No. So they think that he dictated to her exactly
Free
how he wanted.
Dash way.
And- like he spelled everything out the
why
way.
Do they think that
because well here so they okay. say so they also concluded that the letter was most likely dictated by the Freeway Phantom to Brenda, mm-hmm. and she handwrote it. They also speculate that because the note didn't indicate any duress that she may have known him and he was just because he like think about it like if somebody you know is asking you to write a letter because yeah. nothing in that really is I mean like his incense she's 18 so she knows
yeah
you know
yeah so I guess you can explain it away
yeah you can
yeah, yeah.
And because what they're saying is that the because her normal handwriting and the like handwriting like whatever they found mm-hmm. to match it to this note it's exactly the
it
same
it wasn't like shaky
so it wasn't shaky it mm-hmm. wasn't you know and there was punctuation
mm-hmm.
and there was no signs that she was nervous while she was writing this
oh
note
my God.
So they think that like the reason that she was so comfortable writing something like this was because she knew him.
Who would all of these young girls know from all around the city, like a know. Bus driver?
I don't know. Well, Jenkins said that, like, the one thing that I kind of love her, she's such a badass, but she was just like, just think about it. Like, would you calmly be writing a letter to somebody that kidnapped and assaulted you? So she didn't think that she was being kidnapped.
Yeah.
So that's why this didn't mean anything to her. Like, she didn't know that something was wrong until it was wrong.
Yeah.
So, that like that's I'm having the same questions of like who is this guy. Brenda Faye Crockett
mm-hmm.
was the one that made the phone call,
the 10-year-old.
She's the one that made the call,
right?
And the thing that kind of doesn't make sense to my theory that he like they all know him
mm-hmm.
is because then why on the phone did she,
would
not,
she
say
not say who it was
yeah unless I mean
well
he's forcing her to say that he's a white man and
yes.
he's not. And
I researched this when mm-hmm. I was working on a different case about why didn't, you know, Elizabeth Smart run when they went to the library? Like, mm-hmm. why don't people, like, take those opportunities? Mm-hmm. And they are in a mindset of, like, I'm going to do what this person wants and then I'm not going to make them mad and then they'll let me go.
Yeah.
If... Because even if Brenda at 10 years old didn't fully understand what was going on,
mm-hmm.
she knew not to make him mad. And she knew, she would know that if she said his name, it would make him mad, which would put her in
into
more
danger.
Trouble.
Yeah.
So I get why she wouldn't mm-hmm. have said that, because it would have been like she had a chance to get out.
Yeah.
She thought she was going home, at least a bit of her thought she was going home.
And he was feeding her that sense of security that wasn't really there.
So, and she thought she was going home. She's like, oh, I can tell him when I get home.
Yeah. Like, what happened? I don't know. I just have this feeling that, like, this guy's got to be a local man that wouldn't immediately set off. Well, he knows the
area, too.
Yeah. Like, he wouldn't, like, you know, maybe he's just, like.
If somebody saw a white man driving down that street, like, they would know something was up.
Yeah.
You know?
I think that's why it was more, like, he was just a guy that, like, I love your theory of, like, the bus driver. Because it's somebody that they, a face that they always see, a face that wouldn't, like, if he was to offer them something, like a ride home, of course they're going to take it, because this is a guy that they doesn't set off red flags and nothing feels wrong until it goes wrong.
Right.
So, yeah, I stand by that, even though that there's some things that can basically prove my theory wrong. Sure. So... we're almost done. The final known victim, air quoting that because I don't think that this was the first or last that he committed. I honestly think that, like, either he died or he moved. But, I mean, I wouldn't be upset if he died. Or he went
to jail for something else.
Or he went to jail for something else. Or he moved and continued his evil bullshit elsewhere. But, like, let's hope that didn't happen. Anyway, so his last known victim was claimed almost a year later. So he took a huge break between that.
Or didn't.
And we just don't know who those women are.
Yeah.
This was Diane Denise Williams. Body was found on September 6th, 1972, in the early hours of the morning by a trucker who pulled over. She was 17 years old. Mm. She attended the Ballou High School. The night before, she made dinner for her family and then went to her boyfriend's house. She was last seen getting on a bus home around 11:20 p.m. So she cooked dinner for her family, went to her boyfriend's house, and then 11:20 p.m. she got on a bus to go back home. So this was only a couple blocks from his house. Her body was found hours later, strangled, dumped, and dumped along the I-295, also where Carol was dumped as well. She was fully clothed, and you guessed it, she didn't have shoes on.
Green fibers?
Green fibers as well. There weren't any signs of sexual assault, which is different from the other women, but they did find traces of semen, which they assumed came from her boyfriend because she was with him before. I don't think that they asked him, though, because I've, like, dug deep into, like, trying to find even his name, and there's nothing. Yeah,
if he was underage, too, though.
Maybe,
tend to be.
So, I mean, who knows? But I feel like, so why wouldn't they just ask him if they had sex?
Right.
You know? But then they also didn't test the semen either because they didn't have a way to do that.
Right.
So then what was the point, I guess, to bring that up at all?
Yeah. I wonder if his car had a green, like his trunk.
Maybe.
Was lined with like a green. Felty thing.
Maybe. There was a reinvestigation that was opened by Romaine Jenkins, which is where she learned that Johnson's mom got odd phone calls during the time of her daughter missing.
Oh, God.
And Williams' parents, Brenda Williams, or Diane Denise Williams, her parents also received calls with the caller saying, I killed your daughter.
Oh, my God. What?
And it's like, but she didn't find this out until the reinvestigation. So this didn't come out in the beginning. This came out years later.
Why wouldn't they say that?
I don't know.
Maybe they did and it just didn't get it to her. Yeah,
maybe.
So he either knew them or made them give him the family's phone number.
Well, I'm thinking like in the 70s.
I guess you could look people up.
Yeah, and can you call? You
would still know their name. you know, true, you still have to get information.
Is it, I don't know, like in the 70s, did you like call, could you call the operator and they connect you? Is that something that was still done then?
Yeah.
Because that would be a very easy way to not be traced and not be like,
well, they couldn't like trace it.
True.
Anyway.
Yeah. But like to not have like a direct line to anybody is to just say like, hey, I want to be connected to the Williams home on blah, blah, blah. So Patricia Williams did, who is Diane Denise Williams' sister.
Mm-hmm.
She did an interview for WUSA 9 as well in 2008. She became a police officer.
Oh, yes, Patricia, we love
And
you.
She said, I want him to come out and say, I did it. She's like, I've always wished that while I was in the police department, that a case would, or this, a case would bring her to some information that would help solve her sister's case. And she wanted to be a part of, you know, the investigation and be a key role in closing it.
Mm-hmm.
She later married and, has three kids. One of her daughter's middle names is Diane. Her mother, Margaret Williams, is now 83. She still lives in the Haley Terrace home. Margaret told her at one point that she will never be the same again, that it took everything out of her.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Oh my God.
So, I just,
he
just,
is a coward.
Yeah, it's
he
ridiculous.
Is an absolute coward.
So, just a few things from the investigation that I just wanted to point out. So, I got most of this information from the Washington Post article about Romaine Jenkins and a book called Tantamount, The Pursuit of the Freeway Killers. So they found out that the killer most likely bathed all of the victims before disposing of their body. Pardo, one of the authors of the book, said, quote, it could be he was trying to wash himself of the guilt from killing these young girls, but it's also possible that he was aware of police techniques in the 1970s, and he was trying to wash away any trace evidence, but not realizing that when he threw the girls on the floor in wherever he was, that they were picking up trace evidence. So the green fibers could have come from, you know, like a bathroom mat or the floor of his car or just a rug in his apartment or home, that he was washing them to kind of get rid of any evidence. But then within transferring them to dump them, they picked up these trace fibers.
It worked because even with the trace fibers,
he was never found. Yes. So, the geographic epicenter of all the crimes, so the anchor point for where the victims lived and where they were abducted and where their bodies were found, were all near the Elizabeth's Mental Hospital. Or I'm sorry, St. Elizabeth's Mental Hospital. So Hester, one of the other authors of the book, said, quote, he had to have known the neighborhood very well. Police could never gather enough evidence to like point towards anybody specific. But they did question a man who owned a teen club where Darlenia Johnson hung out a lot. And another witness had allegedly saw Johnson in a car similar to this guy's car around that time. So that's why they tried to, you know, put those two together, but it ended up going nowhere. But the police did use sodium pentothenol. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It's truth serum. Am I saying that wrong?
No, I don't know. Like what?
Pentothal. Sorry, sodium pentothal.
I think you mean Veritaserum from Harry Potter.
Yeah. But it was like the first time that they've used truth serum, but he passed, I guess, so they cleared him. In 1990, Jenkins saw the hairs and fibers and handwritten note that were found in Woodard's pocket. And now that there's DNA testing, she pressed for them to retest it. But the law enforcement had done such a poor job preserving all of it that nothing could be done.
Oh,
so they can't test any of the stuff that they have because the evidence was either
mishandled
and mishandled, or it was destroyed or completely thrown out.
Wow.
Like, so many different detectives were involved in this case. Mm-hmm. And usually, I mean, back then what they did was there was no like chain of evidence kind of thing. Like mm-hmm. you files and evidence and stuff like that were kept with the people that were on the case.
Mm-hmm.
But it was such a long time that it passed so many hands that people just started throwing things out.
Wow.
Like they just didn't handle the evidence right. Yeah. And she said that, like, literally nobody knows where the evidence is to even test it. Even if they could.
Yeah.
They don't know where it is.
It is astounding how many cases that
happens.
Comes up. Which is, like, if you think about, like, the physical, how many banker's boxes was that? And, like, mm-hmm. how many warehouses full of evidence? And then what is your system for tracking things in the 70s? Like, you need a full, like, staff of hundreds and thousands of square feet of space to keep all the mm-hmm. evidence in all places. But you would think a case like this would be a perfect time to save things.
No.
Wow.
I listened to because the Murder Squad did an episode on this as well. Mm. And like either they're more about like web sleuthing and stuff like that. So if that's your jam, go for it. but they talk about this as well. And it's really interesting to see hear the point of view from a detective. And I think it was Paul Holes who was like the guy that took down the Golden State Killer, by the way.
Oh my gosh. Fangirls.
Oh my God. He's always going to be on the side of, you know, law enforcement because that's, you know, where he comes from.
Yeah.
Like, that's his blood. But, you know, he does explain that after so many times of, like, he's been to warehouses where there's, like, an inch thick of dust on top of these banker boxes that, like, no one's touched in years and years and years. And sometimes, like, he did mention, like, I don't remember what case he was talking about, but he was talking about how he was on a case a while back where they knew where the evidence and the files had ended up, but that storage room flooded at some point. So then they had to get rid of all of it because there was, either way, it was contaminated. Yeah. So they couldn't do anything about it. So it's just like situations like that happen, and they don't have the manpower. They don't have the people. They don't have the money and the manpower to like keep up with this stuff. But then I think it was Billy Jensen. I'm not sure which one of them said what, but he was like, yeah, but if. Pretty much what you just said, which was just like, I feel like with a case like this, you just shouldn't throw shit out.
Yeah.
Like, how about that?
Yeah.
Like, I understand that things happen.
Revolutionary idea.
But, like, how about we just don't throw things out?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
Wow.
So Tommy Musgrove, he was a retired police detective, said, quote, which we've all thought this throughout this case, but those black girls didn't mean anything to anybody. I'm talking about the police department. If those girls had been white with blonde hair and blue eyes, they would have had put more manpower on this. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
So I just want to outline some of the known suspects, and one of the known like persons of interest, or like people that they pretty much went real hard trying to figure out if they did it. So the Green Vega rapists were kind of a thing, I guess, in Washington, D.C. in the 70s. So apparently there was a couple of suspects who were a part of the Green Vega rapists. And
like a group of rapists?
Yeah. Like it was a gang.
Ew.
And that's what they did as a gang.
Oh, God.
Probably one of the worst gang. I mean, gangs aren't great.
No.
But this is not a good gang to be a part of. So the members of this gang were responsible for rapes and abductions surrounding the Maryland and Washington, D.C. area. And the Green Vega gang members were interviewed by the MP D.C. homicide detectives. And they had to go to Lorton prison in Virginia because they were all there serving sentences for past rapes and abductions that they committed. So So they were all sentenced for those crimes. But during the interview, one of the members pointed the finger at another gang member who he said told him he was involved in the Phantom murders. And he gave information about one of the Freeway Phantom homicides. The inmate he implicated was also serving a sentence there as well. And he agreed to give this information, but only if he could remain anonymous, which I think I would do too, because as a gang member and you're snitching, snitch, like are you kidding me? Snitches get stitches kind of thing.
Nothing from Tekashi 6ix9ine.
Yeah. So, the police obviously agreed to that. I feel that, like, you know, especially in the prison system, like, and they're all in the same prison, like, it would be kind of easy to figure out, like, obviously one of you guys said something kind of thing. Right. So I don't really know his tactic there was to, like, protect himself, but I feel like he threw himself under the bus regardless.
He's obviously an idiot if he's part of a rape gang.
Yeah.
I don't believe this. I have a hard time believing just categorically inmates who are like, oh, I have information about this other thing. It's this other guy, and don't tell them it was me.
Yeah.
Because inmates have so much to gain by giving up other information that a lot of times people will just say whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know about that.
Well, he does identify him. He gives information, the date and the location of the crime. He gives specific details that were not provided to the public. Mm. And this information that he gives them, the detectives are like, well, it was only us or the person that killed them would know this information. And that information did check out. Like, it was right. So,
do you think it was more than one person?
Or copycat?
Yeah.
That, like, snuck in and did one.
But the fight, like, the green fibers.
But not all of the women had green fibers. And if you remember correctly, one of the girls did have her shoes on. So it could have been just
that, like, was the one that claimed his name in the note, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm. So it's like, maybe? I'm not sure. But
and she was the one that was stabbed.
Yes. The only one that was stabbed. Huh.
Do you know which case this guy gave information?
No, it doesn't say.
Hmm.
I couldn't find
anything. Curious, curious.
Yeah. He did, like you just said, say, I wasn't involved at all. I was just told about this. Mm-hmm. And he did give an alibi and it checked out. So they were like, okay.
Was it prison? Was it jail?
No, I don't know. It doesn't say specifically because he asked to be anonymous. Yeah, so they say his name anywhere. But during this time, there was an election going on in Maryland, and one of the candidates publicly announced that a break in the Freeway Phantom case occurred, and that one of the inmates from Lorton Prison had given major information that led to an arrest, or will lead to an arrest. And after that announcement, the inmate would no longer cooperate. Yeah. So he declined any further interviews. He also recanted his statement because he was like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Murdered.
Yeah. So, like, that kind of threw a wrench in the whole thing.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
So Louis Richardson, one of the detectives that interviewed this inmate, went to his deathbed believing that they were responsible. But Jenkins doesn't know that the consensus at that time was that, like, you know, the information that men provided to the police did come from some reports, so, like, they could have pieced all this together to try to get, like, something off of his sentence for past crimes. Yeah,
exactly.
And then once that came out, because he tried to do this under the table without the other gang members knowing he did this. And then once that it was publicly announced that, like, an inmate in this prison was doing, he was like, then he backed out.
It would be easy to pinpoint. I wonder too if in their questioning, because they were arrested for similar kind of things, I bet detectives were trying to feed them and poke and gave them information and was trying to lead interrogations in a way. So maybe they picked up on information about this other case, about the murders, through that, because that's a tactic that people can use. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, police will kind of do anything to, and at this point, I guess they're like literally six no victims in. They're like, okay, we got to figure this out, and we'll try to do what we can to pin it on whoever, you know? So they also knew, like, they also, it came out later that he didn't know anything about the note.
Which that was the one that I was like, if there was a copycat, it would be her.
Yeah. So, like, if he didn't know anything about the note, then maybe this was just something that he was just lucky by, you know, saying certain things that ended up matching up.
Right.
Also, none of the hair samples from the men matched the hairs that were found on the victims. So, suspects, I should say, Edward Sullivan and Tommy Simmons, or sorry, Simmons. Sullivan and Simmons were two ex-cops who were arrested for the murder of Angela Denise Barnes. Angela was 14 years old and was thought to be the seventh victim of the Freeway Phantom, but it was later determined by authorities that Angela was not one of the victims of the Phantom or the Freeway Phantom, and they ended up moving on to other leads.
What was that? Why? How did they determine that?
I couldn't find anything. And I couldn't find...
but then
like,
two
when you look
ex-cops
up,
were arrested?
Mm-hmm, that they were arrested for her murder. And because of the Denise, which I'll get into, they thought like she was one of their...
A lot of name repetitions. Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't make sense how this guy eluded the police for this whole time. It just boggles my mind, especially with like the amount of investigators that were involved and so many tips came in. Like, they had a hotline set up that, by the way, is still set up. I didn't call.
No. Should we call? No, that's not helping.
No, because we're not helping anything. That's what I was like, but I didn't call it. I just know that there's one.
I didn't call.
I sounded really guilty for a second. I didn't call.
Your eyes got real big.
Because your face was like, and I was like, I didn't call. I thought you were trying to read my mind. I swear I didn't call. Because I don't want to, you know, unless I have some information.
I don't think you would have called without me.
No, absolutely not. So, and this, like, I think the thing that pisses me off more than, like, the fact that there was so many... There's so many things involved. There's so many police officers involved. There's so many tips coming in. But, like, I get tips not leading anywhere. Like, I understand that. But to have evidence and it just disappears or people don't handle it well, like, that's the part that pisses me off the most.
Yeah.
So, like, they're doing their jobs, but they're doing it half-ass, which is the thing that pisses me off the most. So, the strongest suspect that they have is Robert Askins.
So, it's always a Robert.
I know. Don't ever name your kid a Robert or, like, let him fall off a... Like, if your kid has a head injury when he's a little boy...
Yes.
...or girl...
And pees the bed and starts fires...
setting things on fire.
...and tortures animals, you failed.
Like, yeah,
because you're like a serial killer.
Yeah, because that is literally the what is it, the mocktail or the cocktail of a killer.
There you mocktail of a killer. non-alcoholic version.
Non-alcoholic version of a killer.
Oh my gosh. For the record, I can't think of anybody else named Robert that's a murderer. So
yeah,
okay. Robert Durst. There, I did it.
Okay
go ahead.
All right. So maybe some people can name their kid Robert.
Yeah.
Here and there. The strongest suspect was Robert Askins, a computer technician and former patient of Elizabeth's mental hospital.
Wait, was he black or white?
I don't know, actually. I couldn't find his race anywhere.
Okay.
I don't know. So, yeah, I have no idea.
Do you know
why
he was in the mental hospital?
Yeah, so he served time there for poisoning and killing a DC prostitute in 1938.
Okay.
And then
he was definitely white. Because if he did that and he were black in 1938, he would have just gone straight to jail or like been fucking lynched or something.
True.
Like, there's no way that a white guy would or a black guy would get off on an insanity defense.
Yeah. Okay.
So, solved.
Yeah. Okay. So he most likely he's white. Yes, because he was let out. So he was let out.
And he was let out.
Yeah. After because, for a legal technicality, he was let out from the mental institution in 1958. So.
So he did like he did 20 years in a mental institute,
and then they let him out.
And then so that was what? How many years?
Well, I don't know if he went later, there.
It was 1971.
Yeah. So I don't know if he went there. To the mental institution or the mental hospital in 1938, but he poisoned the prostitute in 1938.
Oh, I see.
So I don't know how long it took them to, but you're right. They wouldn't have really spent that much time and
resources. That's like a cakewalk or a nice place to be.
No, but you know, but then to be let out 20 years later because of just a legal
technicality. Yeah. He's definitely white.
Yeah, I now that I'm like, I didn't research that, but yeah, he has to be. There's no way.
Yeah. Askins sounds like a white name.
Yeah.
Askins.
Okay, so most likely he's white. He was interviewed about his involvement in the unrelated rapes, and that's when they learned about the prison time, or the time that he spent in the mental hospital. In March 1977, Lloyd Davis, he's a detective, got a superior court judge to sign a search warrant. The police searched Askins' row house and found, pretty much a bunch of women's clothes, scarves, stuff like that. Photos of young girls, a knife that he used in another crime, an essay from a little girl that they don't know who she was. But they also found a bunch of documents that he handwrote using the word tantamount. A lot.
Oh.
So they also found old letters like in jeans and pockets of his that also used the word tantamount a lot.
Wow.
It's such an odd word for somebody to use like all the time. So so it's just like, of course that's like something that links them. They're like, this is probably the guy. They also interviewed people that he worked with and people at the mental hospital. And they said, quote, Askins is known to use the word tantamount when attempting to describe the stress and importance of matters related to his work and lifestyle.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So according to investigators, the reason that this is still something that, you know, the case is still open, but they're pressing it is because they know that he kept textbooks from some of the girls. One of the girls had pink curlers in her hair at the time, and when she was found, when her body was found, she didn't have the curlers in her hair anymore. So they think that maybe he kept them as trophies, shoelaces, stuff like that. So they know that he has or used to keep these things, and for the most part would not throw them away, you know? So they're like pressing people to like, you know, pay attention to these things. Like if you have, you know, a family member who has these items and you're like, why would they keep this stuff? Mm-hmm. Like, what is this? Oh, that could be so a way creepy. To, you know, identify who they were. So the Metropolitan Police Department years ago, we're not investigating this anymore. Like it's done. We don't have any leads. The evidence is gone. You know, there's nothing we can do. But some retired investigators are still, you know, even though they don't work anymore, they're like, this is something that haunts us and we will forever want to be involved and try to help find the killers. With the current evidence that they have, or should I say that they have left that wasn't destroyed or thrown out, they do have some of it, So that's why the case is somewhat still open. Like, it's been closed and reopened several times. But it is, remains a cold case at the MPDC Homicide Division. There is also still a $150,000 reward open for the apprehension of the killer. So there, I did find a Associated Press article by Don McLeod saying, quote, similarity is the catchword of this phrase. Four victims had the middle name Denise. One of them with the similar sounding last name of Dennis. Two shared the first name of Brenda, and all were doing normal things like running errands, shopping, or just walking home, something they did every day. So this makes me think
that
this guy was watching them. They knew him. He was somebody local. He was somebody that, like, a face that wouldn't, like, send off any red flags. And he watched them closely all the time. So he knew when he could catch them in such a vulnerable place where he could just take them. And like I said, Murder Squad did this episode as well. So if you want to hear about, you know, like, the perspective of a detective, like, that's a really great episode. They did a live episode back in December, I think. And if sleuthing's your thing, that's also what they do. So I also, their website, I'll have it in our sources as well, because I did take this little piece from their website. So one of the assignments that they gave their listeners was they want help writing letters to the DC Metro Police to test the evidence that they do have. Oh, wow,
that's great. Let's write a letter.
Yeah, so you can send a letter to 300 Indiana Ave. I'll also link that in our sources and on our Instagram, so you can do that as well. There's also an email address that I will also post so that people can email it.
And then when you send it, take a photo, tag us in it so we know you did it.
Yeah, yeah, that'd be great.
And we'll post when we do it.
Yeah. I do want to end with a little bit from Jenkins. She said the inability to solve the case took something out of her. She's been retired since 1994, but she says the girls are still with her. And she declares that she will search for answers as long as her heart continues to beat. She said, quote, what happens? She was asked this question, like, what happens when people like her and the families are gone? And she said, quote, this will just all be forgotten.
Oh, my God.
And that made me cry. I'm probably crying right now. But I do. I pray that this doesn't, like, get forgotten, because, you know, these girls still, like, even then they needed somebody fighting for them, and they still need someone fighting for them. And even if the killer is, like, dead and gone, you know, like, we want to find answers and closure to give the peace that these precious little girls and their families deserve.
Yeah. Thank you for telling that story.
It's hard, but
yeah. This week's episode was written by Asia Hamilton
and edited by Devin Balsamo Gillis,
with music by Holly Amber Church.
Please rate, review, subscribe, and download this episode. And please go back and listen to the first two episodes.
If you want more information, you can follow us on Instagram at DNA_podcast. And tune in next week as we tell a story together again. Thanks for listening.
See you next time.